interventional cardiologist from the Palo Alto VA, and I'm also on faculty at Stanford. And I just recently finished a career development award with HSR. And so the focus of today's talk is on some of the work that I did for that CDA. And the topic is promoting equity in cardiovascular procedural care in the VA healthcare system. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the changing landscape of cardiovascular disease burden and procedural care. Then we'll go into some of the COVID-19 impacts and then discuss some of the approaches that we have been working on in our group on promoting equity in cardiovascular care, focused on scalable peer coaching to support decision making among diverse populations, some digital tools that'll be kind of fun, and assessing SDOH needs in the VA healthcare system. So I'll start by saying, after decades of progress in the field of cardiovascular medicine, we were alarmed to see that heart disease mortality actually increased in 2022. Among all forms of death, heart disease ranks at the very top. That's not something that we want, but it's greater than all forms of cancer combined, COVID-19, accidents, stroke, and the AHA heart and stroke statistics that say that it is the most common cause of death in both men and women. It's also the most common cause of death in the world. Within heart disease, coronary heart disease is the most common type of heart disease, and that is the kind that I treat as an interventional cardiologist. So along the last 40 years or so, there have been tremendous innovations in the field. And to kind of give you a sense of how new this field is, when I was born, not to date myself, but I could have never said that I wanted to become an interventional cardiologist because the field did not exist yet. The first balloon angioplasty, where they put a wire down a vessel and inflated a balloon to open up a blockage, occurred in 1977. Fast forward to 1994, when the first stent was approved, and we've since then had multiple generations of stents. It wasn't until about 2008 where it was well known the benefits of drug-eluting stents. Alongside that, the Impella, which is a pump that we can put inside the left ventricle that supports the pump function of the heart, was FDA approved. That really expanded options, not just for treating patients in cardiogenic shock, but also allowing us to do more complicated procedures. As you can imagine, when we inflate a balloon in the left main artery, we stop blood flow to that entire portion of the heart. And so having a pump to assist, especially with patients with poor ejection fraction to start with, has been very helpful. Additional tools along the way, like OCT, optical coherence tomography, have allowed us to see inside the artery itself, down to the level of like 5 to 10 microns. So that, alongside with intravascular ultrasound, have really improved our ability to both diagnose problems as well as treat problems within the vessels. More recently, intravascular lithotripsy, which was actually invented by one of my colleagues here at the VA Palo Alto, allows us to use ultrasound waves essentially to pulverize calcified lesions inside the vessel, and that has really expanded our options for treating severe disease. So, we consider sort of from 2008 and on to be sort of the modern era of drug-eluting stents. And along with the coronary innovations, there have also been, in the last 10 to 15 years, an immense amount of structural heart interventions. And by that, I mean percutaneous options to fix structural problems in the heart. Probably one of the best examples is transcatheter aortic valve replacement, TAVR, where we put a catheter in the femoral artery, we feed it all the way up around the aortic arch, and we basically put a new prosthetic valve inside the patient's stenotic existing valve, and it starts working instantly. And this procedure takes sometimes half an hour, and often the patient is awake while this happens. And so this has become an alternative to open heart surgery, which was the only option for many decades. Around here on the right side, you can see some other options. We have started to put valves in the tricuspid position. We can close holes in the heart with an ASD PFO occluder. There is a device called the MitraClip that basically reduces the amount of leaking out of a leaky mitral valve. In the top right-hand corner there, you can see a left atrial appendage closure, which closes that tiny appendage in the left atrium where clot tends to form, especially in patients with atrial fibrillation that can predispose them to having a stroke. So the field has rapidly transformed over the last few decades. And when we think about all of these new innovations, I turn back to this original description of the diffusion of innovation curve described by Everett Rogers originally in the 1960s. And this was not specific to cardiovascular innovations, but all kinds of innovations. And basically the idea is that, you know, first it's the innovators who are adopting it, then the early adopters, then the early majority, the late majority, and then the laggards is what he called it. We know from many studies across different fields that racial and ethnic minorities tend to sit at the far end of this diffusion of innovation curve. And the factors that influence how quickly innovations are adopted are, of course, the innovation itself, the people who are adopting them, time — every innovation takes time for adoption — the communication channels where people are learning about the innovation itself, and then the social system. And that's a combination of both external factors like organizational or governmental mandates, all the way to internal factors like how closely you associate with a opinion leader, or how strong or weak your social ties are to other people who know about the innovation. So I want to start by sharing actually quite an old study now. It was one of the first looking at racial differences. The original Tactics TIMI 18 study was a trial looking at patients with heart attacks and non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome. And they were looking at whether going directly to the cath lab, an invasive approach, was better than using medications and only going to the cath lab if they developed a problem. In the main trial of over 2,000 patients, they saw that it was there was an improved MACE at 6 months of the invasive approach. And this study here was subsequently looking at the differences between non-white and white patients. And there were about 460 non-white patients in this study. After extensive adjustment for baseline characteristics, hospital type, comorbidities, they saw that non-white patients had a higher MACE rate than white patients. But what was most interesting to me in this study was that when they looked at the protocolized parts of the randomized trial, so where patients were required to get an angiogram or required to get certain treatments, there was no difference between non-white and white patients. But when they look at the non-protocolized aspects of the trial, like the option to get a follow-up angiogram or medication options, non-white patients were less likely to be treated than white patients. And for the purpose of this study, they actually only focused on Black and Hispanic patients. All other minoritized groups were excluded. So as you know, the demographics of our country are rapidly changing. This is a map from the U.S. Census showing the percent immigrants by county, and the dark blue represents more than 32%. And even the demographics within the immigrant population are changing, with the proportion of Hispanic decreasing and the proportion of Asian increasing. But as you recall, you know, a lot of the early studies completely excluded Asian patients. Fast forward 20 years, we took a look at the nationwide inpatient sample, which comes from the Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project. It's a great database in the sense that it is probably as unbiased as you can get because it includes all payers. It includes all inpatient hospitalizations. So we looked at patients coming in with acute coronary syndrome, and basically after looking at those who had a real heart attack or unstable angina or ST elevation MI, saw that still 20 years later, Black patients were less likely to receive PCI. And among those who received a stent, Black patients were less likely to receive a drug-eluting stent, the kind we know have longer patency and better outcomes overall. And then when we looked at the timeliness of guideline-indicated care, we saw that Black patients were less likely to receive an angiogram within 24 hours if they came in with what we call an ST elevation myocardial infarction, so a full occlusion of the artery, which typically we use 90 minutes at, we call it a door to balloon time, as the expectation of good quality care. From the moment they walk in the ER, that's the door, to the balloon time, the time the balloon is inflated inside the artery to open up the blockage. And then in cases of non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, angiogram within 48 hours was received less often in Black patients as well. Now, in this study, it was interesting that the highest in-hospital mortality, though, among all these groups was among Asians, despite the high use of early invasive therapies. So that really made me want to understand better what was going on in the Asian population. Now, unfortunately, with most large data sets, if Asians are included, they certainly are not disaggregated into their different subgroups. But the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, which is a mixed payer healthcare organization in Northern California, has uniquely collected this kind of subgroup data for more than a decade now. And so we were able to collaborate with them to look at what the CVD prevalence among Asian American subgroups has been. And here you can see over a decade, the blue line is the white population as a reference. And we see that these are the ones shown here are only the statistically significant ones compared to the reference. But the within this sort of overall Asian group, Filipino patients had significantly higher CVD prevalence overall compared to all of the other ones. But when we then divide this down and to look at the kinds of cardiovascular disease, we see that that high CVD prevalence among Filipinos is really driven by a high prevalence of hypertension in the top left. In the top right, you'll see that in for coronary artery disease, actually almost all of the groups were lower than the white reference, except for Asian Indian patients who in recent years have had a rapidly escalating increase in CAD prevalence. And certainly we have seen that in our clinical practice as well. When patients come in with a heart attack and they're in their 40s, we often see that they are of Asian Indian origin. In terms of MI prevalence and PVD prevalence, a lot of the Asian subgroups actually were lower than the white reference. But I think the point of this study was really just to reveal that there are such differences between these different Asian subgroups, and that really makes sense given the genetic diversity as well as the cultural diversity within the Asian subgroup, Asian group as a whole. When we also looked at the types of therapies in these different Asian subgroups, we saw that Chinese patients were more likely than non-Hispanic white patients to receive PCI if they had a diagnosis of CAD, and Filipino patients were more likely to receive coronary artery bypass grafting. But of course, across all of the groups, there was a lot of variation in terms of what types of procedural therapies patients were receiving. So if we turn for a moment now to look at transcatheter aortic valve replacement, which has kind of revolutionized the way that we treat structural heart disease. This is a graph showing the last basically decade of both surgical aortic valve replacement and transcatheter. The orange and blue represent surgical volumes, and the yellow line represents transcatheter volumes. And what's notable here, not only about just the growth of TAVR over time, but that the SAVR lines are only slightly decreasing in recent time, suggesting that the TAVR procedures are actually not replacing surgical procedures, but really expanding the treatment options for patients with severe aortic stenosis. But when you kind of look more closely at what that yellow line represents, you see that really more than 90% of the patients receiving TAVR are male and female white patients. And that while Hispanic and Black patients have had slowly increasing uptake over time, it has really lagged far behind the white population. Here is a study we looked at the national VA population for another structural heart procedure called mitral valve transcatheter edge-to-edge repair. You can see in the top right, it's basically like a little paperclip that pulls together the leaflets to decrease leaking from the valve. And here we see that the rate of uptake among white non-Hispanic patients in purple has been a nice steep increase, while Black and non-Hispanic and Hispanic groups have had an increase, but at a much lower rate. Another study we looked at was obesity treatment in the VA healthcare system. And here we looked at all patients in the national VA system with a BMI over 27. That ended up being over 2.4 million patients. And what's interesting here is that we didn't find, the straightforward kind of disparity in treatment that you might expect. But that when we looked at the three different treatment modalities, so one being surgery, gastric bypass surgery, and one being the category of medications to treat obesity, and another being the MOVE program, which is a VA-specific behavioral therapy program, we found actually differences in treatment. So for surgery, we found sort of the least differences, although Black patients were less likely to receive gastric bypass surgery. You could argue that surgery is a little bit more protocolized in a sense, if you think back about the Tactics-Timi trial findings. in that, you have to have a very specific BMI cutoff. You have to have criteria that are met in order to qualify for gastric bypass surgery. So we did see some disparity there. But some of the most notable disparities across all groups were for medications, like semaglutide that has received a lot of attention lately, for its efficacy in obesity treatment. And we saw that all of the minoritized groups were less likely to receive anti-obesity medication treatment. However, they were more likely to receive the MOVE behavioral therapy treatment. And so this persisted after extensive adjustment for all baseline characteristics, sociodemographic factors, facility. And so there's some interesting findings here about, why is it that certain types of treatments are being preferentially given to certain patient populations? So I'm going to talk briefly here about some of the COVID-19 impacts that we have seen with relating to myocardial infarction. So when the pandemic first started in March of 2020 in the VA, we basically had a halt to all of our cardiovascular procedures with the exception of ST elevation myocardial infarction. Now, you can imagine we as cardiologists were really concerned because we have all these large randomized trials showing that we improve mortality with these procedures. And so it was almost like a natural history experiment to see what happens when we don't do those procedures or the patients don't come in. So this was a study that we did in collaboration between Stanford and the Providence Healthcare System, which is a number of different hospitals across six states, mostly on the West Coast. And we were trying to see what was happening with procedural volumes for heart attack and what those impacts were potentially for mortality. So while the procedure volumes dropped dramatically, especially during that first COVID phase, they did basically bounce back as we progressed in the following months, although not all the way. And we were glad to see that it didn't seem, at least in the short term, that mortality took a hit from this reduction in procedures. And when we pan out into a longer time frame, though, and this is looking now at the National VA healthcare system, we saw the same drop in, now this black line is representing non-ST elevation MI diagnoses. So this is a little bit more patient-driven, and these are the patients coming in with a heart attack. We saw that same drop in the first COVID phase, and it did start to come back in the second COVID phase. Although what you'll notice is that over time, those numbers really never bounced back to their pre-COVID levels. On the bottom there, you can see kind of like also tracked is just the daily COVID positive cases in the VA across time. And so what worries us is that maybe patients are, because of COVID, they stayed home even though they were having a heart attack. And the question is, what is that impact over a long period of time if people are not getting treated, and when are we going to see the impacts? Is that what we're seeing with these higher heart disease mortality rates in 2020 starting in 2022? The other thing we saw that was intriguing was that, we wondered, well, maybe the reason why they're not coming to present with a heart attack in the VA is that they're actually just going to their local hospital. And then, practices have changed, VA policies have changed. So when we looked at patients with an MI going to a non-VA facility, but that was paid for by the VA compared to veterans who were receiving care in a VA facility, across COVID phases, we saw that 30-day mortality was lower among veterans who presented to VA and got their care in VA facilities. And this persisted after adjustment for baseline characteristics and comorbidities. And it makes us wonder, well, what was it about the MI care or the patients during this time that were resulting in these lower mortality rates? And one question or possibility is that when patients get care within the VA system, they get comprehensive end-to-end care. They're not just coming and getting a stent and going home and then all of their other care providers have no idea what happened. They don't know what the medications they're supposed to be on. Within the VA, it's very easy. Any provider can go look at those angiogram films, can make sure that they're getting the meds they're supposed to be on and getting the appropriate follow-up. That is one possibility. There are many other possibilities we could talk about. So let's get into some of the approaches that we have been taking to promote equity in the VA. I'll first just start by saying that when we rewrote the updated coronary artery revascularization guidelines through the ACC, AHA, and SCAI, you know, there were so many different large randomized trials that we were trying to integrate into this document. But the number one take-home message that we listed here was that efforts to reduce disparities of care are warranted, and that there's no evidence that any patient of any sex, race, or ethnicity benefits less than others when it comes to revascularization. You may have seen this diagram before that I think really demonstrates what we are going for. If the idea that, you know, the optimal outcome is for everyone, all these people in this picture, kids or patients, to see the game, you know, in reality, some people start off with a leg up and some people start sort of in the ground. And if we try to aim for equality, then the idea is that we're giving everyone equal access in this picture to a box to see the game. But obviously, you can see that doesn't achieve the goal of getting everyone to be able to see over the fence. So equity is then moving to figuring out what specific support we need to make sure that everybody can see over the fence. And if we really move forward all the way to justice, we get to the point where the systemic barrier, the fence in this case, has been removed and everybody can see the game without supports or accommodations. I've also seen it discussed that maybe the ultimate next step is inclusion, where the kids are actually playing the game. So when we turn that to focus back on the decision-making process that our patients undergo when they're deciding to undergo these novel cardiovascular procedures, it's challenging. There are many features of these types of procedures that are different than other novel procedures that patients are deciding about. So some things that are the same: access to specialty care can be very limited, especially during the early phase of these novel procedures. For example, MitraClip is only performed in 14 VA centers across the country. And just certainly during the early TAVR days, it was the same. So currently right now at the VA Palo Alto, you know, we performed the first TAVR when it was done under a research protocol a decade ago. But even now we have patients coming from across multi-state borders to come get their procedural care with us. And you know, getting on an airplane to go get a specialty procedure is easy for a 40-year-old, but some of these patients are 80, 90s. We've even done a few 100-year-olds who are getting these procedures. So limited access can be quite challenging. And not only getting the procedure is important, but also getting follow-up with the appropriate specialist can be challenging if you have traveled a long way for that procedure. Patients are also not only just deciding, should I get a procedure or not, but they're weighing multiple procedural and non-procedural options. So is it TAVR that's the optimal decision? Is it SAVR that's the right approach? Or is it medical management that makes the most sense? And there are many factors that influence each one of those decisions. For example, patients have to weigh their own life expectancy versus what we know about valve durability. So if you imagine that TAVRs have only been around for 10, 15 years, then if a patient has a life expectancy longer than that, someone say in their 60s, then they might be worried that what if the valve gives way, you know, and I need another procedure 10 years down the road. Now, we have certainly developed techniques like valve in valve to address some of these problems. But in reality, some of our younger patients are really struggling with this aspect of the decision. Another challenge is for patients who have to think about the severity of their aortic valve disease versus competing comorbidities. One example is patients who have COPD, and their lung disease is so bad that when they complain of shortness of breath, we actually don't know whether that symptom is mainly coming from their severe aortic stenosis or if it's coming from their lung disease. And in some cases, we really tell them that the only way to really know if how much is going to reduce that shortness of breath is by treating the treatable disease. But they have to understand that it may not take away their symptoms completely. Patients have to weigh issues of quantity of life versus quality of life. There can be severe impediments to quality of life in patients with severe AS. And then something that's very unique about these types of procedures, TAVR in particular, is that it's one of the only procedures that a cardiac surgeon is standing right next to an interventional cardiologist at the table deploying the device. So you have an interventionalist who has trained in medicine and cardiology holding one end of the catheter, and you have a surgeon who has gone through a completely different training process and they might be holding the back end of a catheter at the table. And so, of course, anytime you get such diverse experience, while we think it's critical to the procedure, patients might experience competing professional advice. If they go to a surgeon, the surgeon might say, well, you might be a good SAVR candidate. And particularly during the early days when we really weren't quite sure yet whether TAVR was better than SAVR, patients might get differing advice depending on who they talk to. Now, the great advantage of increasing evidence is that large clinical trials can guide us and help to align all of the parties in knowing what might be best for a patient. But that's certainly an additional challenge when patients already might have some mistrust of novel procedures and then they're hearing different advice from different physicians. So let's talk about for a moment those large clinical trials that we rely on so much in cardiology. So, when we advise our patients, we often say, well, in these large trials, this is what we found, and that's what we use to inform our advice for them. The problem is that for decades, particularly in cardiovascular medicine, our clinical trials have severely underrepresented minoritized patient populations, including women. This was a viewpoint that Dr. Fearon and I published last week in JAMA Cardiology, talking about the underrepresented representation of women in revascularization trials. And I'll just read you the first sentence. One could argue that the most shocking finding across decades of large clinical trials that deeply investigate coronary revascularization is that women are still poorly represented in them. We know from the AHA heart disease and stroke statistics that 55% of all patients with acute coronary syndrome and coronary artery disease in the US are women. And yet, less than 30% of most clinical trials of those diseases include women. So, when I'm talking to a female patient and I'm saying, well, I'm going to give you this advice, but it's based on a trial that was done mostly in men. We're at a severe disadvantage in how we can advise appropriately our patients without the diversity in the trials that we need. So I have, outlined keys to improving equity in cardiovascular clinical trials. One is going where the patients are. For many years, the large clinical trials have been led by, esteemed investigators at sort of ivory tower institutions, but that means that the patients that we are enrolling are the patients that attend those ivory tower institutions. And so if we want to diversify our trials, we also have to think about where the patients are and go to where they are. We also need alignment across the clinical trial spectrum. If you expect a clinical trial enroller to somehow enroll more women, for example, at the point where they're in the clinic or in the cath lab, it's impossible for just that single encounter to make a difference because at the end of the day, what influences the patients that form the eligible pool of candidates for a trial is going to be driven by the patients who get treated. And we know that women are less likely to receive guideline-indicated care compared to men. So if less of them are ending up in the cath lab to begin with, the likelihood that they can be enrolled in a trial in equitable numbers is going to be even lower. But even if that were to happen, the issue is that we need alignment starting from funders who have to understand that it might take longer, it might take more money to enroll a representative population. And the funders aren't going to want to do that unless even the journals are demanding representation as a measure of quality of a clinical trial that should be published. So that alignment is really important. Part of the solution here is diversifying principal investigators themselves. So this was a study that we did looking at a decade of cardiovascular clinical trials on clinicaltrials.gov. We looked at more than 620 trials and used a API using name to identify the gender of the trial investigator. And we saw that over almost a decade here, there was really no change in the proportion of female PIs compared to male PIs. However, what was interesting is that the women PIs in their studies, they recruited more women than in studies that were led by male PIs. Now, there are multiple potential reasons for this, but at the end of the day, it suggests that one of the solutions is to diversify leadership. And that would be the practical benefit, but of course, that there are other justice-related benefits as well. Now, part of the problem of diversifying trial leadership is that you then have to think about the pool of candidates from which we draw leadership from. And when you look at the field of interventional cardiology, which is where a lot of the trial leadership comes from, less than 5% of interventions in the United States are performed by women, for example. So this was a piece I wrote when I was very early in my faculty position. And I told a story about my first experience at our major interventional conference. There were more than like 10,000 people there. And I looked on the stage and I saw there were all men on the stage. And then I looked in the audience and they were all men. And then I walked out and ran into a huge line for the men's bathroom. And there was no one in the women's bathroom. And this was just a joke because we use so many signs in cardiology, but I called this the reverse bathroom sign, which was basically just a sign that there were huge gender imbalances that we had to resolve in our field. Since then, we have taken a lot of steps to try to resolve this. One of the things that I tried to do was to understand why fellows in training did or did not want to go into the field. And so this was a national survey. I did it in collaboration with the American College of Cardiology. And we asked about 600 fellows across the country the reasons why they might or might not choose the field. And we found some interesting differences by sex. Women were more likely to not want to pursue interventional cardiology because they had concerns about the sort of old boys' club culture, about radiation during childbearing. And I think that has kind of helped us to understand some of the work that we need to do to make it a more desirable field for all of our trainees to want to enter. Some of this involves addressing functional biases in procedural environments. For example, traditionally, the lead that we wear in the cath lab doesn't cover the left breast area. And these are sort of the functional things we need to fix. And we also need to look into what are the ways that we are selecting people to go into the field that might bias who even applies to begin with. So recently we looked at the impact of virtual interviewing on the diversity of fellowship applicants. We pooled data from 6 years at Harvard and Stanford and looked at all of the applicants and saw an association between virtual interviewing and increased diversity of applicants. So turning back to our aortic stenosis patients, we wanted to understand really what was the natural course of where patients went once they were diagnosed with an echocardiogram. So one of our residents did an extensive chart review. We looked at all patients over a four-year period who had had an echocardiogram in the Palo VA and found those with severe aortic stenosis and then looked at what happened to each one of them. And while some of them got treated, some of them died prior to replacement or prior to referral, there was a certain population here that we wanted to understand more. Those who either declined care, were deemed not a candidate, they were lost to follow-up, or they were referred and really there was no procedure that had been done. And that information combined with sort of the anecdotal information that I experienced talking with patients in clinic sort of informed our next approach. So I started to notice that when I would talk with patients with disease in the clinic, and some patients would want to get treated and some wouldn't. And I would just ask them, why is it that you made your decision? And those who wanted to get the procedure done often would say that they knew someone who had had the same novel procedure. My aunt had a TAVR, so I think it's the right choice for me. And on the flip side, patients would say something like, well, you know, I think I'm going to go for the surgical option because I don't know anyone who's had this TAVR before, so I'm not really sure if it's the right thing for me. And it's interesting to me because, you know, the chances that that patient's neighbor has the exact same clinical indication as them is a little unlikely. But the fact that they apply the learnings from their peers and their social networks so strongly to their own decision was interesting to me and made me realize that the way that our patients make decisions are probably not the same ways that we are making decisions. And I wanted to understand that better. So relying on the Ottawa Decision Support Framework, which is an evidence-based theory for guiding healthcare decisions, I wanted to better understand what were the decisional needs that patients had, their knowledge, expectations, their values, the resources and things they were using to deal with decisional conflict, and what kinds of decision support might be useful in guiding those decisions. And hopefully that could inform the quality of the decision. And so first, to do this, I wanted to interview our veteran patients and better understand this. So we conducted some interviews in person and over the pandemic, some of these were done over Zoom. I've compiled just a very brief clip from some of them, and I appreciate and thank the veterans who granted their permission for us to share this. So here's a short clip of some of our veteran patients with severe aortic stenosis describing how they made that decision.
I think that the most impressive thing, indeed, it was progressive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's overriding. That if you do nothing, your chance of survival is very low. In fact, I could look up the, you know, the survival rates for various diseases and found that the one year survival for arterial stenosis is extremely low. It's lower than most cancers. A 5-year rate also is extremely low.
And then he said that you have some serious problem needs to be taken care of. Then that's when I quit postponing it, because I did postpone it because I'm afraid, you know, and I'm human. And then, but something kept telling me, the creator, of course, that you got to get this taken care of because I have responsibilities.
I couldn't walk from the front door to the street without, taking breaths. I said, okay, we got to do something. I don't want to live this way.
When I found out my sister had it done, and she's fine, so I figured I'd be fine also.
What I was then faced with was open heart. It was basically the standard procedure that had been around for 30 years. And the more I read about that, the more I felt like, well, that seems like 30-year-old technology. I mean, the fact that you're open, you shush, you spread your, you know, it just seemed like barbaric. Well, in my particular situation, if I go through the traditional gold standard, which the phrase once used by a physician, if I was to have a typical valve replacement operation, my recovery might be difficult with the situation I was in, with knowing absolutely no one. I mean, if I had to call somebody to take me to a doctor, I wouldn't know who to call.
So we are in the process now of compiling all the themes across patients, and I've learned so much from our patient population. I wanted to share another study that we worked on. This one was done in collaboration with Google engineers. So the issue here that we were trying to address was that, you know, patients who have heart failure certainly benefit from clinical exams from heart failure specialists who can tell them when they need to uptitrate some of their medications or make changes to prevent them from being hospitalized for heart failure. One of the problems is that some of our patients live so far away, and the thought of them driving getting in a bus for 4 hours one way and back just to get a physical exam is not practical. And this was even worse during the pandemic. And so we thought, what are ways that we can improve remote monitoring for these patients? And so this was a study where we brought patients in who were already planning to get a right heart catheterization, so an invasive measurement of the pressures in their heart. And we had a cardiologist go to the bedside and do a physical exam and assess what they thought the jugular venous pressure was by looking at the patient's neck. These were blinded to another group who took a video of the patient's neck and then did Eulerian video magnification. So much so, and I will show you this video in a second here, that not only could a non-cardiologist look at the video and assess the jugular venous pressure, but even a computer could look at it and get a decent exam finding. So here on the left-hand side, you'll see the unedited video. And you can see there's a little bit of movement of the JV jugular vein here. Maybe you can see it up to the neck. I'll play that again. Maybe even up to the jaw if you look carefully. So a cardiologist could look at that and tell you, oh, that's elevated. But if you look at the right-hand video, you can see that it's magnified so much that actually even the computer could tell. And we actually, in 50 patients, when we compared the cardiologist at the bedside exam to the computer assessing this magnified video, we had similar results. So if we could have a computer, basically AI, tell us what needed to be done for a patient with heart failure, we could really change management for our remote patients. However, you know, now that AI is everywhere, there are significant concerns. While we can see the tremendous advantages of trying to overcome biased data and thinking back about the sort of protocol and unprotocolized findings from the TACTICS-TIMI trial, AI can help to overcome that. But at the same time, it's going to be subject to whatever information we put in, whether that be sampling biases or other biases that enter in through the data. And if we do have those biases, we can find ourselves, you know, sort of exacerbating the disparities to begin with by repurposing those AI systems, delivering biased healthcare delivery, unequal resource allocation, biased clinical decision making, and even resulting in unequal treatment. So we do have to be very careful in the way we deploy these tools. Now, you may have heard the story about the streetlight effect. The officer says, sir, is this where you lost your wallet? And he says, no, I lost it in the park, but this is where the light is. And I really worry that sometimes as researchers, we investigate the things that we know how to investigate and that we have access to. But really, maybe that's not where the problem is. So when we think about, you know, we sit in this figure in the green section, you know, where the healthcare providers are and the healthcare system, and we look at all those factors and how they influence health and health outcomes. But if you pan out, really maybe where the majority of the impact is on health outcomes is really in social determinants of health, where they have direct effects on outcomes as well as the indirect effects through the healthcare system. And so one thing that I have been interested in doing is trying to understand how those social determinants impact cardiovascular health outcomes. Part of the problem is that we don't have easy ways to study this. There have been studies in the past looking at social determinants of health in the form of ICD-10 codes and found that in most healthcare systems, these Z codes are coded in less than 2% of patient populations. However, earlier this year, we found that uniquely in the VA healthcare system, our coders are coding these Z codes for social determinants of health in really, really high numbers. So when we pulled all patients with cardiovascular disease diagnoses in the national VA system, we found that more than 50% had at least one Z code for a social health need, a health-related social need in our system. And so that allowed us to then look at all of these different codes, there are probably about 60 of them, and we grouped them into 5 different categories according to a SDH framework. And we then found that social and community context, as well as social risk, were able to predict 1-year all-cause mortality, even after adjusting extensively for patient characteristics, demographics, clinical comorbidities, adjusting for facility. And that's a very meaningful finding for us. We saw that all of the categories predicted 1-year readmission. So this suggests that maybe there's something here that we need to dive into more, and that the role of social risk is a critical one we have been not paying attention enough to date. So the emergent lessons that I have gained from some of this work is that it's not just about large database analysis and the stats, but there's real power in understanding veteran journeys at scale. And that while the pandemic exacerbated cardiovascular inequities, there are a lot of novel technologies that may allow us the ability to overcome them if we can figure out how to use them appropriately. And likely we are underestimating the value of social support in health outcomes. In summary, there are rapidly changing US demographics and procedural advances that are making achieving health equity an increasingly complex problem. And this has only been exacerbated by the pandemic. Despite tremendous advantages of novel technology and AI, there are risks we need to pay attention to that could widen disparities in care. And there's that more research is needed to identify and address the most impactful barriers for veterans. The VA is uniquely poised to address these problems, and much more work has to be done there. I wanted to thank all my mentors and collaborators, and this is not an exhaustive list, my statistician and research coordinator, the fellows and residents who have really led a lot of this work with me and even my undergraduate trainee. And I appreciate all of the funding sources, including the VA HSR CDA award, and most importantly, our veterans for their generous time and contributions that have really made a difference in this work. I will stop sharing there, and I wanted to open it up if there are any questions or comments.
Thank you, Dr. Young. Attendees, if you have questions, and we definitely want to hear from you, please do submit your questions to the Q&A, and you may not see the Q&A open. In order to open the Q&A, you need to click on the ellipsis, the three dots in the far bottom right corner, and you'll see Q&A as a sub. In a sub menu, you can open up the Q&A there. We did get one in, Dr. Young. They talk a little bit about their experience in research, but quite simply, they wrap up with what do you think can be done to increase VA participation in clinical trials?
Sure. Thanks, Rob. That's a great question. You know, when we look at the clinical trial sites for these major cardiovascular trials, a lot of them have been in a lot of the sites that we, you know, see time and time again. They have robust infrastructure. They have trialists who have a lot of experience with doing prior trials. But increasingly, because funding institutions are now requiring reporting of diversity of participants, I think increasingly trial leaders are looking to find sites where there is a diverse patient population. And I have seen when I interact with trial organizers, that is one of their most important questions. What is the patient population that we may enroll? And I think across the VA, we have a very diverse patient population. And in general, I've found that, you know, the VA Palo Alto has participated as a trial site for a lot of different trials. And we end up being among the top enrollers among all participants in these large multi-center trials. And so I think explaining that to potential clinical trial leaders, I think can reveal that the VA is a great place to do research. We have a patient population that are eager to serve and are diverse. And I think that can be a great selling point. Additionally, the VA tends to have, believe it or not, lower costs than some of the private institutions for administering some of these trials. And I also hope that in getting to know each other better, we can also collaborate across institutions to promote trial enrollment and trial participation. If any of you are interested, we are trying to put together a VA Health Services Outcomes Consortium, a national one where we would be able to collaborate with other researchers across the country who are interested in these common themes of research. And feel free to reach out to me if you'd be interested in being part of that sort of very early group that we were just starting now.
Thank you. We got a couple more in, but since you're saying reach out to me, could you tell me what your email address is again, since we're not
broadcasting? Do you want me to just type it in the chat here?
Yeah, if you can, and if send it out to everyone. Do you have those rights?
There, I think so. Did that go?
Yes.
Yep, perfect.
So
yes.
The next question this person asks, where/how does VA guidance for health equity tie into clinical trials? Thank you for this great presentation.
Oh, thank you. I mean, the VA has prioritized health equity from the highest levels. So, you know, I think being able to contribute on multiple levels to promoting equity, it basically meets the priorities of the VA as well as our national priorities. You know, as you guys know, when you're applying to grant funding through the VA, one of the top priorities is understanding how our research is going to impact or promote equity. And I think that has become a theme in much of all the research that I've seen, and certainly the research that our group has been doing as well. So I think integrating it into every aspect of your own research and thinking about the implications, as well as external facing, like when we interface with outside groups, I think is a way that has been prioritized at every level.
Thank you. Same person, same questioner. How can the VA improve diversity in training populations in areas that are not too diverse? How can we replicate great practice in less diverse facilities?
Did you just say with training? specifically about training?
Yes. How can the VA improve diversity in trainee populations in areas that are not too diverse?
Ah, that is a great question. So I think this affects every single one of us. You know, we are a lot of our VA hospitals allow trainees to come to our institutions and train with us. And regardless of the diversity of the existing physicians and practice care members at an institution, we can reach out to our trainees, and in particular, those of diverse backgrounds, to encourage them to go into the field to pursue areas that are underrepresented. I have a lot of women trainees who come through our training program at the VA Palo Alto. And although I can provide direct advice about my experiences as a female in the field and encourage them and help them overcome some of the barriers, like the radiation exposure and stuff like that, thinking back about my experiences as a trainee, you know, there were no women that I knew at the time who had kids and had who were practicing in interventional cardiology. But the men who were in leadership positions were very, very welcoming and open to helping me figure out what was the right career path. And I think the point is that all of us can help to encourage the diversity of our trainees and encourage people to overcome the problems that they might face as they try to enter these fields that have traditionally been had underrepresented populations in terms of their representation.
Thank you. Somebody wrote Joint Commission NPSG 16.01.01. I think that was to try to help answer a question, perhaps.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
And somebody else wrote in last question. Oh, I was one of the person who questioned earlier. Could Dr. Young expand on her why? What empowers her work in this area?
Oh, interesting. You know, this is going to go back a little bit, but I think we all have personal experiences sometimes that we draw on. And when I was young, you know, my parents came from Singapore and Malaysia. At the time, they were developing countries when they lived there. And as a kid, hearing their stories about poverty, I think really stuck with me. And that I just felt from a very early age that it seemed like everybody should be able to get access to good healthcare. And so when I was an undergraduate, I did some work at the White House. This was way back when Clinton was president, looking at underserved populations and their access to healthcare. And then progressing sort of through the years, I did some work with the World Health Organization, USAID, understanding disparities in care all over the world, traveled to Senegal and India, and saw some of the barriers that our poorest populations were dealing with respect to gaining access to healthcare. And interestingly, when I came back to do my medical training at San Francisco General Hospital, I realized that those very same problems that I was seeing all over the world were right in my own backyard. And I realized that I did not have to go anywhere to try to solve these problems. And so started working in homeless communities in San Francisco, doing HIV training and counseling. And then as I, you know, progressed in my training, I saw that in cardiovascular disease, which was fascinating to me, I saw the same disparities in care. And I thought, well, you know, it's the number one cause of death. There are these huge disparities in care. Where can I direct my energies to try to make a difference in resolving these problems? And so kind of it's been I think the underserved healthcare has been a focus of mine, you know, even long before I realized that I was interested in cardiology. And so it's always interesting to me to hear about other people's experiences and what they rely on that informs the work that they do today. But I think mine started from childhood, really.
I think at this time, we don't have any other questions queued up. That doesn't mean that they won't come in. But we only have a few more minutes left. So maybe if you make closing comments now, we'll get another question or two and we can use up the whole hour.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I just wanted to thank everyone for attending today. I wish I could see you all, you know, in this WebEx thing, I can see your names, but I can't see you. So please do reach out if you are interested in collaborating on any of this work. I'm always really excited to learn from people at other institutions in particular who are working on similar missions and how we can work together to tackle some of these really challenging problems. I think one of the great advantages of doing research in the VA is that we have this shared system and there's a lot of potential there. So I'm hoping that we can build on that together. So please reach out.
Thank you, Dr. Yong. We didn't get any questions in while you made your closing comments, but thank you for your work in the VA and for preparing and presenting today. Attendees, when I close the webinar momentarily, a short survey will pop up. Please do take a few moments and provide answers to those questions so we can continue to provide high-quality cyber seminars based on your responses like this one. Thanks again, Dr. Yong.
Thank you so much.